Absolutely, and we're with Paul Davies, his latest work, The Eerie Silence. And this hour, we'll take your phone calls with Paul right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Paul Davies with us. We'll take your phone calls this hour. Paul, I want to thank you for staying with us. By the way, do you travel much, Paul?
I travel almost continuously. So I'm off to London tomorrow. Just a week ago, I was touring the West Coast, and the week before that, touring the East Coast of the United States. And I've already made two trips to Britain this year before this one, and it goes on like that right through the year.
How did Paul Davies get interested in science?
Well, I tell people I was born a physicist. But, from the earliest age I can remember, when I grew up in North London, I was fascinated by scientific things. I can remember looking up at the sky as a 7 or 8 year old and just seeing this wonderland of stars and strange objects and thinking, you know, what was it all about? And I was always interested as well, looking the other way into inner space, the atoms and things you couldn't see and mysterious forces and force fields and things like that. So right from the start, from the very earliest age, I was hooked on science, and it's been a passion that's been with me my whole life. I was resolved to become a scientist in my early teens, and I just stuck to it, and I'm very fortunate that I've been able to live out my dream.
Excellent. Let's go to some phone calls here, Paul. This hour's going to go by very quickly. West of the Rockies in Modesto, California. Aaron, you're on with Paul Davies. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hello, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Mr. Davies, let's say we do get a sample of life from Mars, okay?
Right.
And we have all this technology to sequence DNA.
Right.
Can we take that sample and test it to find out if we were related, or can we be on such evolutionary different paths that the DNA might not be similar at all?
Right. So earlier I was saying that Mars and Earth trade rocks, and they've been doing this throughout their history, and microbes can hitch a ride in these rocks. And so if you get life on one of these two planets, you get it on both. And so there's every chance, if we have a Mars sample return mission, which is one of the objectives of the astrobiology program, the spacecraft will go there and bring back rocks for us to study, we might just find evidence of microbial life in those rocks, and it may very well turn out to be the same life as ours. That is DNA-based life. We could sequence the DNA and position it on the known tree of life. It would simply be an organism like any others related to us with a common origin, either on Mars or Earth, but stretching back a long way. What we'd be much more excited by is if we brought back a microorganism from Mars that was completely unrelated to life on Earth, with a different organization, a different biochemistry, something that was so different that we could say it must have had a separate origin. That's what we really want. We want life 2.0.
Well, what do you think of the possibilities of the United States, the European Union, getting together to send astronauts into space, to back to the moon, off to Mars, rather than what's going on right now?
I think a lot of people have lost interest in the space program, that the International Space Station just goes round and round, doesn't really go anywhere, and that the bold opening up of the high frontier, which was so much part of my youth, all that zeal has gone away. And I'm afraid that probably the United States isn't going to get it back. I look to China and maybe India in another 50 years as being the trailblazers. My feeling is that we could go to Mars now with current technology, with the political will, but it needs to be a one-way mission only. And I push very strongly over many years that the idea that we have to have an expedition and bring the astronauts back just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's far, far cheaper to go one way only and to set up a permanent base on Mars that will become the nucleus of what would eventually be a Mars colony. It would be ultimately self-sustaining over a few centuries.
So you're saying, though, whoever
astronauts now,
whoever goes, they're not coming back?
That's right. So this is not a suicide mission, but of course you send on equipment ahead so that they can build a habitat. and grow some food for themselves, and they can be resupplied every couple of years, and eventually other colonists would come to join them. And of course, their life expectancy would be reduced, but so would it if they came back. So my feeling is that this would cut the cost enormously, and the sort of people you would send would be scientists who could do fantastic work on the Martian surface. They could make new discoveries, publish their results. They would go down in history, the trailblazers of a colony on a new planet. There'd be plenty of people who would volunteer for that. It cuts out all of the complication of having to take the fuel for the return journey and all those other things that push up the cost. But the political will isn't there. It's very sad because it seems to me so obvious that this is the way forward for Mars exploration.
That would be an incredible mission. The volunteers for something like that, no doubt, huh, Paul?
Plenty of volunteers left Europe and came to the United States knowing they wouldn't be going back. Maybe even been people who've gone off to Antarctica pretty much in the knowledge that there's only a 50-50 chance they would survive. But they did it. 100 years ago, there was that sort of expeditionary exploration zeal. We seem to have lost it, at least in the West.
Let's go to Danville, Illinois. Richard's there, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie. I'm Professor Davies. Excuse me. In Star Trek, they have something called a non-interference directive. And I was wondering how this might fare also with some speculations for over 30 years by various scientists that it wouldn't be a good idea contacting any advanced civilizations. Also, they could be out there just hiding and watching us over, like, for an example, on Earth, certain organisms like the trapdoor spider and the tunnel spider, which supposedly is only from northern provinces of Australia. But believe me, brother, they got them here.
Yeah, they do.
And
I'm
some
familiar
other...
with the funnel web spider. I still have a house in Australia, and we have funnel web spiders around the house from time to time. This idea that there is some sort of sinister agenda that the aliens mean us harm, I've never been able to take that seriously. What possible interest could we be to them? I can understand that our planet may be of interest to an extraterrestrial civilization that maybe is depleted in resources and wants to, like I was just talking about, we could colonize Mars. Maybe they will want to colonize Earth. Well, that's fine. Our presence on Earth is going to make no difference one way or the other. They could have come to Earth any time in the past 4.5 billion years. If they did come, they didn't stay. And so the idea that somehow we're going to be responsible to bring this down upon us, I've never understood this. That if we imagine a hypothetical civilization, say, 1,000 light years away, which you, if you ask SETI optimists, how near is the nearest civilization likely to be? That's the typical sort of distance. Well, they could have instruments powerful enough to see that planet Earth has all what it takes as a place to live. So if they wanted Earth for the planet, they could have come at any time in the past. They don't need us to tell them about it. They don't need us to be in contact with them to invite them here. They could just come anyway. The fact that they haven't suggests to me that either they're not there at all, or that if they are there, they're not interested in taking over our planet.
Paul, if we're being visited, why is it shrouded in secrecy? Why don't they make themselves known?
Right. I don't take seriously the idea that we are being visited. As I said earlier, I think it's not impossible that some sort of probe or expedition could have passed through the solar system sometime during its history. But that's an awfully long history. It's 4.5 billion years at any time in that stage. Some sort of alien activity could have happened here. But we then have to think on a time scale of billions of years, not thousands of years, billions. And so over those immense periods of time, it's very hard to know, as I said earlier, what would survive, what remnants, what trace there would be of some alien visitation. I can't take seriously the idea that the aliens are coming here now. Why should that would just be too much of a coincidence? They should happen to show up just as we started getting interested in them from watching Hollywood movies or something. You know, just the world doesn't work that way. If the aliens were going to come, they've had a long time in which they could have done that. And for them to just show up at this particular time, it's just too much of a coincidence. I couldn't take it seriously.
Charles is in Mojave, California, and you're on with Paul Davies. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, you just about touched on my question. It seems to me one of the things to focus on and look at, perhaps with a system like MicroLaunchers to examine thousands of near-Earth asteroids, to look for the chance that perhaps somebody, even a billion years ago, had sent in a robotic spacecraft, which is how we would investigate a solar system. It would do its thing, send its messages, and then be here still orbiting among the near-Earth asteroids. And it seems reasonable that it might be directed to come in to the inner part of the solar system where the interesting planets are, you know, the rocky terrestrial planets. And the solar system 4 billion years ago was probably highly recognizable, I mean, probably very much resembled the way it is now. So it might be worthwhile to develop a program to try to photograph by actual flybys thousands of near-Earth asteroids in hopes that one of them might be an old, worn-out, spent spacecraft, which would still be physically intact, of course not functional, but recognizable as an artifact.
Right. I think I agree very much with your suggestion.
Yeah, and micro-launchers might be a way to do it. It's a way to send thousands of 100-gram photographic spacecraft out.
What I have done in the Eerie Silence is consider precisely this possibility. There could be a probe that has been in our solar system for a very long period of time. It might be dormant. It might still be functional. It might be waiting for us to activate it in some way, or it may just be passively listening, monitoring our radio broadcasts or monitoring the internet, and one day we'll announce its appearance. The favorite place to put such a thing is the so-called Earth-Sun Lagrange point. So these are points in space where you can keep pace with Earth as it orbits the Sun without using any fuel. But the asteroid belt, so if you wanted to hide something, of course, there's thousands and thousands of objects there. You could easily hide a fairly large craft in the asteroid belt without us being aware of it. To search the entire asteroid belt is an immense undertaking because there really are a lot of objects there. Some of them can be photographed quite well from Earth or from near space. The same probes there, I think, would be a pretty massive undertaking. But you're entirely right. So there could easily be some alien probe there, and it could have been there for a long period of time. One other scenario is that if there are alien civilizations that are hungry for resources, one of the things they might do is move in on a newly forming planetary system and scavenge the raw materials as it's forming. And so we could look at freshly forming planetary systems, such as in the Orion Nebula, and look very carefully for large-scale astroengineering projects or for systems that are depleted, for example, in certain substances, anomalously depleted in certain substances, and wonder if, in fact, you know, ET has sequestered them all. So these are all the sorts of things I suggest in the book.
There's a theory by a Zachariah Sitchin, Paul, that from his interpretation of Sumerian texts, that we were visited 400,000 years ago for that purpose, to mine for resources and to bring them back to their planet. So the similarities are pretty uncanny.
Well, you see, apart from this timescale, 400,000 years sounds like a long time in human terms. But you know, in astronomical terms, it's really very recent, and I would be astonished if such a visitation happened in the such a recent past. And of course, there's no way that the Sumerians could possibly have known such a thing. So I don't take reports like that terribly seriously.
It sounds like, Paul, you would not be surprised one way or another, that being we're the only ones in the universe, or that the universe is teeming with life.
Right.
I think you could accept either possibility, right?
And I think this is the correct attitude for a scientist to take. Scientists should always be skeptical, and they should always be open-minded. These are not conflicting, but you have to take the view when reflecting on these difficulties, imponderable subjects. You have to take the point of view, well, if we don't have any evidence, then the correct position to take is skepticism. We must never close our minds to the fact that that one day the evidence may be forthcoming. So my attitude is, we don't know one way or the other. because we don't know how life began. We don't know if it's a fluke event or if it's a highly expected event. Fashion in my lifetime has gone from it's a fluke event to now that it's everywhere. But we don't know because we don't know how life began. If we could only crack that problem, we'd move this subject way, way ahead. And that's why I invest so much importance in looking for life 2.0. We can just find a second sample of life on Earth, then we know that the universe is going to be teeming with it. And then the way lies open for looking for all life elsewhere, and in particular intelligent life. But until that time, it would not surprise me if we are in fact alone in the universe. This is the only planet with life. It's just a bizarre freak event in one little corner of the cosmos. That would be very sad, in my view. Some people think it would give us greater significance, but I think a truly bio-friendly universe would, for me, be much more congenial. But that's just a sort of philosophical position, not a scientific one.
All right, let's go to Los Angeles. We go. Go ahead, Douglas. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yes, Mr. Davies, I want to ask you a question. I've been involved in the COSPAR, the Committee on Space Research. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am, yes.
All right, and Jill Tarter, she's done some things there. But what is what I'm wondering is why the SETI does not check out the serendipitous discoveries and developments of instruments. Back in like 2002, it was submitted through the COSPAR and to trying to get to Jill Tarter in California, the guy that developed the instrument and has already made the contact. He talked to a Kent Coolers. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Kent Coolers. He's a blind guy at the SETI Institute.
Oh, right, right. Yes, I know who you mean, yes.
He was taking calls for Jill Tarter, but it's already been done. The instrument has been developed, but the SETI does not come out to even see. They've been invited to do the...
I'm a little baffled as to what instrument you're talking about.
It's called the Davoscope Air Trans 3. It's an acoustical audio optical image receiver, transmitter, transducer, transponder. It was developed by a young guy, 20-year-old guy in Texas at the J.C. Trimble Tech. He was in radio school, but it was an accidental development with like a 1 meter emission grid. It was kind of a joke. He just said, this looks like an emission grid. Let's see what happens.
But you said acoustical.
Yeah, acoustical audio.
Well, but acoustics is no good beyond the Earth, I'm afraid, because it's space out there. And
no, they're transmitting with the extraterrestrials are transmitting on a flat beam that is actually carrying acoustical along with, it's a pulsed flat beam, but it's also traversing a sound actually is going along this flat beam of pulse, beam of light.
But I must stop you. Unfortunately, sound doesn't travel through space, so it's not a lot of help, I'm afraid.
It won't get here, or vice versa.
Right.
Paul, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment with the final segment of phone calls for you right here on Coast to Coast. Paul Davies' work, the latest one, The Eerie Silence. We'll be back. Well, with our floating format tonight, next hour, William Forstin joins us as we talk about an EMP, electromagnetic pulse. Could it hit America, and what would it do? We'll be talking with William about that. And when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with physicist Paul Davies on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, when you talk about the possibility of life out there, life here as well, do you sometimes bring in the spirituality at all? And most scientists do not. I was wondering if you.
I've reserved a section of my book for the impact on religion of the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence. And I might say also the discovery of any form of extraterrestrial life. We were talking earlier about the search for life 2.0, whether we live in a universe which is intrinsically bio-friendly, so life pops up all over the place wherever there are Earth-like conditions, or the opposite extreme, which is it's a freakish event that's happened only once. And I feel that these are, in a sense, spiritual issues. Some people feel that to have life unique to Earth invests it with a certain significance it would otherwise lack. I feel exactly the opposite, that a universe which brings forth life and who knows, mind as well, as an integral part of the outworkings of deeply bio-friendly laws, to me, is the more spiritual point of view. So these are weighty issues, and inevitably deep questions like are we alone in the universe touch upon those aspects of life which we could most broadly call spiritual. And I think everybody, whether they're conventionally religious or not, has that dimension to themselves. Everyone wonders, looks up at the universe and sees how majestic it is and wonders, what does it all mean and where do I fit in? And SETI, in a way, is part of catering to that that deep spiritual yearning, but to know who we are and where we fit into the great scheme of things.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go. First-time caller, truck driving in Virginia, Katura is with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Good, Kat. Go ahead.
I just want to say thanks, first off. My question is, you know, you hear all this about aliens and everything getting mixed in with religion and everything, and I do believe that all mixes in somehow or another. Why don't they allow us to look under the foot or the base or whatever of the Sphinx? Because I've heard repeatedly that there is so much information, literature, I don't know if it's what it is, I don't know if it's just stone tablets, but there's all kinds of things up under the feet of the Sphinx. I mean, what's the big deal with they've let us dig everywhere else? Why can't we dig under there and find out what Edgar Cayce said about the Atlanteans and everything else? That's my question, because they also said that there is information on alien life form along with other information that actually goes into religion.
All right. I'm going to answer this for you, Keturah, and Paul, I'll let you chime in if you want. The American prophet, the late Edgar Cayce, once said that there were three areas on this planet that contained Hall of Records, one being in Bimini, the other somewhere around Central America, and then the third being at the base of the Sphinx. It has been found that there is a cavern somewhere at the base of the Sphinx by the paw. Zahi Hawass has said on this program, there's nothing there. I'm not so sure. I think maybe the Egyptians know there is some kind of chamber there. Whether they've already dug into it or not, I don't know, Paul. But that is part of some of the things that you're saying, and that is archaeological digs that could show up some kind of evidence of some kind of past that would be very important to us.
Well, I don't think so, no. I think I've been at pains to point out that if there had been any alien visitation on Earth, it's likely to have been, you know, typically 100 million years ago, the idea that there have been aliens on Earth within historical times, so there would be records that could be dug out of an archaeological dig, seems to me just completely ridiculous, because it would be far too much of a coincidence that the aliens should show up just as humans were occupying the planet. Human beings, human society on this planet is only a few tens of thousands of years old. The planet is 4.5 billion years old. We're not talking millions, we're talking billions, immense periods of time. Why would it be the case that in this universe, which is 13.7 billion years old, there were stars and planets around long before the solar system even existed, why would it be the case that aliens should show up on our doorstep just as human beings were here? It would just be too much of a coincidence. So if we're going to find evidence for alien visitation, it will be an immense period of time, long before there were any humans. We're not going to get any help from archaeological digs, I'm afraid. It will be from some other type of survey altogether.
Let me ask you this about the formation of the solar system and the universe in general. If the universe is around 13.5-14 billion years old,
right,
and our solar system is 4.5 billion years old,
correct,
what happened in that gap of you know, 8.5 billion years? Why did it take 8.5 billion years for our solar system to get developed?
Right. Well, you must understand that star systems, planetary systems, are forming all the time. You can see them forming now. So, for example, the constellation of Orion, I think, is familiar to all Americans. There's the belt of Orion, and beneath that, the so-called sword of Orion. If you look through binoculars, you'll see that the middle star of that sword is, in fact, not a star at all. It's a great mass of gas, and embedded in that gas are newly forming stars and planetary systems, hundreds and hundreds of them. So planets are forming all the time, stars and planets forming all the time, and they have been back through the history of the galaxy. And so it just happens that our particular solar system formed about 4.5 billion years ago, but there were plenty of others forming before that, And we can see these more ancient stars, and very soon we'll be able to see the planets that are going around them. And so it's a continuous process, and we just happen to be, in the middle of this great drama. There will be stars still forming in another 3 or 4 billion years' time.
Why didn't we form all at the same time? I mean, if the Big Bang occurred, why wasn't everything just done at the same time? Was it because
when the Big Bang coughed out all the gases, they were smoothly distributed. And the only reason that we have any stars and galaxies is because gravity pulls these gases together and eventually causes them to get more and more clumpy. And that process is very slow. We can now model that on computers and simulate it very, very accurately, formation of clumpiness and aggregation of material. But it's a slow process. Gravity is a very weak force. It takes a long while to pull things in. And so the first stars were superstars. They were giants that burned very quickly and then exploded. And the next generation of stars were smaller, and they contained some of the material from those first generation stars. And so it's been going on. There's no real mystery about this. It is just the gravity is a weak force, and these are slow processes.
All right, let's go to Mike in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Mike, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Davies.
Hi.
Can you explain why there are thousands of sightings every year by credible witnesses, and yet SETI goes on? And also, can you give us any information on a consultation that you gave to Rockefeller?
Right. I think we've dealt with these things earlier in the show. The SETI's got nothing to do with UFO stories. SETI is searching for evidence for alien technology way out there across the galaxy somewhere. So far, it hasn't found any evidence for it, but they go on looking. The UFO stories are like ghost stories and fairy stories. They're stories. They're not scientific data. I explained earlier how I was involved in the early days with Alan Hynek, the chief scientific advisor to U.S. Air Force Project Blue Book. Mm-hmm. I explained a number of cases myself. I think the alien abduction stories are sleep disorders. The lights in the sky have all sorts of explanations ranging from meteorological effects to the ball lightning, and who knows, maybe some mysterious physical effects that we haven't yet explained but will do soon. But I see none of this as evidence for extraterrestrial visitation. I keep saying it would just be incredible, far too much of a coincidence, that aliens would come here now just as we're getting interested in them, when they've had 4.5 billion years to come to our planet. It just doesn't add up to me.
Next up, we go to Lexington, Kentucky. Steve is east of the Rockies. Hey, Steve, go ahead.
Hey, Dr. Davis, it's an honor to speak with you. I just had three quick things, and I'll take my answers off the air. On your website, you had mentioned physics and cancer and working with the U.S. National Cancer Institute, and I was wondering if you would expand on that work a little bit and what their aims are and what that research is about.
Yes, I'd be very pleased to do that. The National Cancer Institute spends many billions of dollars of taxpayers' money annually on cancer research and the conventional research, which is these days primarily gene-based and chemical-based. It's proceeding on a broad front. But when you look at the statistics over the 40 years or so since President Nixon famously declared a war on cancer, the mortality rate from cancer has hardly changed. Very, very depressing. And so in an extraordinarily bold move a year or so ago, the National Cancer Institute decided to spend some small fraction of its resources to get thinkers from outside of the field. And they are particularly impressed by the fact that physicists have a good track record of solving complex problems by thinking about them in creative and innovative new ways. And so they have set up a network of 12 centers of physical science and oncology, and I head up the one here at Arizona State University. And so we have physicists and physical chemists and mathematicians working together with oncologists and cancer biologists just to try to think cancer in totally new ways. It's very exciting. It's very challenging. And I really do hope it makes a difference. We need that big breakthrough, that penicillin moment that has transformed other ailments. We haven't seen that in cancer. That's what we're after.
Go ahead, Steve. Couple more questions.
Okay. You had also mentioned the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences, and I was wondering what your work involved with them was. And I was also wondering if you could comment on the Large Hadron Collider and what that device might be able to tell us about how life may be able to develop and start from inorganic origins.
Right. Well, we've got a fair range of questions there. I was just last week lecturing at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences in Berkeley. I have no formal association with it. They invite me there from time to time to give talks about the overlap between science and theology. It's something that's interested me for many years. As far as the Large Hadron Collider is concerned, this is a particle accelerator, so this is not directly connected with the issue of the origin of life, much more connected with the issue of the origin of the universe. This machine, which is in Switzerland, can recreate the conditions that prevailed 1/1,000,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang, when the universe was intensely hot. And so by colliding protons together at enormous energies, we can glimpse the sort of processes that helped forge the structure of our universe right back at the very beginning. But this has only a very indirect bearing on the problem of the origin of life, which came much, much later.
Douglas is in Fresno, California. Hey, Douglas, go ahead.
Great show tonight, George. As always. Dr. Davies, a great honor to have a moment of your time.
Thank you.
I have to admit I haven't read the latest book yet, but I'll run out and get it tomorrow. The last one I read, though, was How to Build a Time Machine.
Right.
In which you discuss the various components required in building a hypothetical machine of that sort. In particular, I was interested if you could maybe discuss that subject a bit, maybe elaborate upon one of the particular components involved, a negative energy source through the Casimir effect.
Right, yes.
Has there been any recent progress in that area in terms of, say, amplifying that effect? Would something like a negative energy laser be a possibility?
Right.
And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Douglas.
Right, right. I mean, this is the subject of my previous book, and the short answer is I don't think that there has been a great deal of progress since I wrote that book. But the notion that there can be negative energy is thoroughly established. These are weird quantum effects. And harnessing them is an enormous challenge. But we know that in principle it could be done.
Okay, very good. Shane in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Hi, Shane. Go ahead.
Hi. Good show tonight. Dr. Davies, I have a question for you. You said you were searching for life 2.0, and ever since I've been listening tonight, I've been stewing this question in my brain, and it's that, have you or anybody in your field taking into account that or looked into the fact that viruses may be life 2.0, considering how different they are than the rest of biological, and that they may be alien or they may have been a second start to life?
Now, it's very interesting, this whole subject of viruses. Now, the viruses that we're familiar with, the common cold and the AIDS virus and smallpox and things like that, they're definitely the same form of life. And the reason they're dangerous is precisely that. They infect cells, living cells, with the same sort of DNA and get into their works and basically create problems. Now, of course, what we can't rule out is that there are virus-like particles that prey on cells which are not life as we know it. In other words, this life 2.0 might be there, and it may well have viruses that are parasitic upon it. And we could go look for the viruses instead of looking for the cells themselves. The point about that is the viruses get everywhere. So if, for example, you take just a cubic centimeter of ocean water, it's crawling, well, crawling is probably the wrong word, but it's replete with viruses. The ocean is pretty much virus soup. And so one of the things that's not been done, but I'm urging virologists to do it, is to look very carefully to see whether some component of that viral soup might be viral particles which are contain not DNA or RNA, but some other type of informational molecule altogether. And that would be a very strong pointer to the existence of life 2.0.
Paul, why do we have this desire, this quest to find out if we're alone in the universe. It's inside of us. It eats away at us. How come?
Well, it is. And earlier we were talking about the spiritual dimension of this entire exercise. And I think we're born, really, with this desire to know how we fit in. Ever since human beings have tried to understand their world and to look beyond just their daily lives and try to see the bigger picture, they've been intrigued by these sorts of questions. And I think that the notion of us sharing the universe with other sentient beings is a very, very powerful one, and it goes right back into ancient history. Because if you look at all early societies, they all had some sort of mythology around the notion of other sentient beings elsewhere, either living in the sky or under the ground or appearing to them in dreams or something. But this notion that the universe is populated by beings as opposed to just objects is something very, very deep-rooted, and it goes back into ancient history and presumably has a deep biological explanation in terms of our evolutionary path.
Let's go to Indianapolis, Indiana. Alan, we've got about a minute for you. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Davies?
Yes, hello.
I was wondering if you could tell me what the sensitivity is of the SETI radio telescope, the Allen Array. For example, I know if it were set up on the moon, it would be able to detect the electromagnetic leakage from the Earth quite easily.
Oh, yeah.
Well, how many light years away would it still be able to detect the Earth?
Right. You have to decide on the strength of the transmitter. But if you ask the question, could it pick up a TV station on a planet going around the nearest star, then the disappointing answer is no. Even with that sensitivity, it could not detect routine traffic. But if you had something like another Allen Array or an Arecibo telescope on a planet going around the nearest star beaming directly at us, then yes, we picked that up.
Paul, we're out of time. I want to thank you for spending two fascinating hours with us. Paul Davies, the Eerie Silence. You were last on 6 years ago. Let's not wait that long again, okay?
The time goes so quickly. It's 6 years already. But
we've got a time travel next time, don't we?
We're going to have to do that. But at least now I'm almost on the same time zone. I'm now living in the United States.
It's a big difference. Thank you, Paul. Paul Davies, up next, we will be talking about EMP. Could we survive it if it happens? We'll be back.